not very good on the magnitude of inflation.
Yeah, somebody was asking me something. So I put up some questions on the wiki. Dan has already done that. I may add a few more today, but okay, let's give them one more minute. People are getting lazy. Hello. Okay, let's start. So yesterday, we started on the working out the cross-section of a QED process, which involves two different kinds of leptons. So leptons are point-like fundamental particles of nature. Oh, I've already written that. Leptons are point-like fundamental particles of nature. And there's also a lot of them, leptons also carry electric charge under the same U1 global symmetry that electrons and positrons are charged under. Okay? And muons, I think, was discovered in the 30s, right, in some cloud chamber cosmic ray experiment. So the tree-level Feynman diagrams for muon-antimuon creation through electron positron annihilation is this. So this is the momentum of the incoming electron. This is the momentum of the outgoing incoming positron. And so the internal photon momentum is P1 plus P2. And we also have an outgoing muon with momentum K1 and spin label KR1, K2, R2. So yesterday, I didn't write down the Lagrangian for this process, but the Lagrangian I had implicitly in mind was this guy. So the total Lagrangian has a Lagrangian for the electron, where the interaction between the electron and the positron with the Maxwell field is hidden in this covariant derivative now. Okay. So remember that the covariant derivative is defined to be, I think there was a minus sign in my definition or plus. I can't remember. Yeah. So this is how the covariant derivative was defined. So if, and similarly for muon, and the mass of the muon is different from here. And also the wave functions So not the wave functions. The field operators are different. And a lot of times in these calculations, you'll see people use the same symbol, U and V, both for the electron and the muon, although they are different particles. And what they have implicitly in mind is that the particle that they're talking about is labeled by their momenta and spins. So, you know, keeping, instead of putting, say, U, E for electron, and then U, mu for muon all the time, what people do is that U with the P1, the argument refers to what particle they're referring to in the Feynman diagram. So this would be, you know, so this is would be K1, and this is the muon. Okay, so these are some conventions. And of course, we have the Maxwell field. Implicit in all these calculations is that when we are quantizing, we are adding the gauge fixing term to this action. Okay, so we know the Feynman rules, and let's write down what the amplitude for this guy is. We wrote it down yesterday, but it's worth repeating. So let's start with one of these, you know, fermion lines. Let's take this one and work backward against the flow of the arrow. So at this point, an incoming positron is annihilated. So we associate with positron Vs. And this is a V bar. And according to our Feynman rules, and P2. And at this point, I have to add a vertex factor. And the vertex factor is I gamma mu. And then I go this way. At this point, an electron, incoming electron, was absorbed. And electron, we associate U's with electrons. So there is an S1, and there's a P1. And then a photon propagates from here to here. So the photon propagator is minus eta mu nu divided by P plus P2 squared, which the shorthand for that is S. And I'm going to omit the plus epsilon, but you have to remember that's always there. And then we come to this fermion line. So start from here. Here an electron was created. So electron wave functions, spinner wave functions, we associate U. And because it was outgoing electron, it's a U bar. And R1 and, okay, I've been talking rubbish. A muon was created at this point, okay? Because our incoming states are, this is an E minus, this is a E plus, and this is a mu minus, and this is a mu plus, okay? But the point is, it's a particle, mu particle that's going out, like mu minus that's going out. And so we are writing U. And here is, you know, I want to point out that the U here is not the same spinner as the U here. And that's, this U here comes from the fact that it's actually in the expansion of a muon. And that's, you know, labeled by K1. Okay. I don't know. I don't think you ever have to deal with contractions of different U's. So, at least not in this theory. So, U's coming from different. Okay. Although, you know, functionally they might have the same dependence. So, okay. So, And then the vertex factor is I gamma nu, so mu nu, everything. Because there is no external photon, you know, all these indices have to be summed up. And then lastly, we have an anti-muon going out. So whenever we have an antiparticle, we associate a V with it. So it's an R2, K2. Okay? So this is my amplitude. Do you agree? Okay, good. So we are interested in processes where we average over the initial spins and sum over the final spins. Although, you know, you'll see lots of papers where they actually compute the helicity-dependent amplitudes, and it's actually a lot harder. So see if you didn't sum it over. But for an introductory QFT course, let's sum over these things. So we are interested in the average, so it's sum over the final initial spin, so it's sum over R1, R2, S1, S2. So R1 and R2 are the final spin labels, R1, S1 and S2 are the initial spin labels. And this is what we want to calculate. Okay. So to calculate this, I told you that we have to take complex conjugate of M. That means taking complex conjugate of these two guys, everything here. But note that this thing is a scalar, right? It's made out of a column matrix, a 4x4 matrix, and a row matrix, a 4x4 matrix, and a column matrix. But this thing is a number, right? And this is a number, of course, by definition, because there's no matrix here. It's a tensor, but not. And then this is also a scalar. Okay. So that means that when taking the complex conjugation of these guys, we can employ the following trick. So the complex conjugation of a number is the same thing as taking the Hermitian conjugate of that number, right? Because a number is a 1x1 matrix. So if you take the Hermitian conjugate, then Hermitian conjugation, you know, reverses the order of matrices. So we have US1, P1, dagger. And then we have I of gamma mu dagger. There was a gamma zero acting on the V dagger from the right. That gamma zero is now here, and there's a dagger on it. And the V doesn't have any daggers on it. However, we know that the gamma mu dagger is given by so this guy, gamma mu dagger, is given by gamma zero, gamma mu, gamma zero. And you know that gamma zero, we have chosen the convention in which gamma zero is Hermitian. And we have chosen the Dirac algebra convention to be such that gamma zero squares to one. So putting all this together, we can write this as u bar of S1, P1, I gamma mu of u S2, P2. Okay. So using this identity on both of these guys, we can write, we see that the complex conjugate of this will have these operators, but in reverse order with the bars switched. Then we have Okay, you guys are sleeping today. What have I not put into my my amplitude? E, good. Why did you say? What? Okay. Anyway, got to keep me honest. Okay. So we have then e to the power four. Sorry, not. Yes, and s squared. There's a 1/4 here. Summation. And V bar S 2 P 2 gamma mu U of S 1 P 1. This is just this bit, and now I multiply it by its complex conjugate, which is U bar of S 1 P 1 gamma nu. It's a different index now. V S2 P2. So that's, close this bracket, and now we deal with this guy. Now I can use this eta mu nu to contract this gamma with this gamma, which in the squared matrix means that this thing has to be contracted with the square of this thing. So we get from here u bar of r1 k1 gamma mu v r2 k2. The complex conjugate is v bar r2 k2. Then there's a gamma nu, and then there's a u r1 of k1. So this is what we have. Now, let's look at one of these guys. So this one, A. This can be B. And see how we can simplify this. So A has the form that there's a sum over S1 and S2, and V bar of S2, sorry, my S's are inconsistent. V bar of S2, P2. Now I'm going to explicitly put in the spinner index, so that's A. And then there's gamma mu, there's A, B, and then U of S1, P1, there's a B, then U bar of S1, P1, there's a C here, there's a gamma nu here, and gamma nu, okay, we don't have to do that, has C, D component, and V of S2, P2 of D. You might say, why am I doing all this boring stuff? But it is absolutely necessary. So now, I've written everything in terms of their in the explicit matrix indices. So everything here is just numbers. So I can move them around, keeping in mind the indices. So what I do is that I take this guy and move it at the front. Then I have S1, S2, V of S2, P2, D, V bar of S2, P2, A, gamma mu of A, B, U of S1, P1 of B, U bar of S1, this should be a P1. P1 of C, gamma nu of CD. This is what we have. So now look at the indices. A A, B, B, C, C, D, D. That means this is a trace. Okay? That means it's a trace. And so we can say trace sum over S1, S2. Okay. Sorry. That's one more step. It's a trace if we interpret these guys as matrices, 4x4 matrices. Now remember that we had some identities, completeness identities, that I didn't prove. I just, you know, told you to do that yourself. Was the identities was that if you sum over the spin of us of p u bar of s of p, you get p slash plus m, which is a 4x4 matrix. And if you have u sum over v of s v bar, then you get something similar. So now we can use these to do the sums over S. And when we do this, we get, this is replaced by P slash M DA. And this is replaced by P slash minus M BC. And then we see that everything is traced over. So we can now write this as trace of P slash plus M gamma mu P slash minus M gamma nu. Ain't that nice? So similarly, we can write B as a trace as well. And once we have done that, our 1/4 of summed over mod M squared becomes E4 by 4S squared trace of P2 minus mass of the electron gamma mu P1 slash plus the mass of the electron gamma nu. Okay. So here we see that the fact that this was a these were electron spinners become important because you get the mass. Whereas in the second trace, you have trace of K1 slash plus mass of the muon. So this is mu for muon, not an index, okay? And then mu, gamma mu, k slash 2 minus m of gamma nu. So this is a muon. So this is what we get, OK? So now, you know, remember the second or the first tutorial for this part of the course. I think it was tutorial number 6. We did trace identities. And in the trace identities, we learned that if there is no gamma 5 around, the trace of odd number of gamma matrices vanish, right? And we proved that by inserting a gamma 5 squared. So that means that of the four terms that is possible here, only two terms survive. So what are those two terms? The terms which are, which do not have M or are quadratic in M. So we get trace of P2 slash gamma mu, P1 slash gamma nu. The other thing I'm going to note at this point is that the mass of the muon is about 100 MeV, and the mass of the electron is about, how much is the mass of the electron?
0.5.
Sorry?
0.5.
0.5, yes, 0.5 MeV. Right, good. So this is much, much bigger than this, so we might as well treat the electron as massless. You see, if we are going to produce muons in this scatter in this experiment, the center of mass energy of the electron has to be huge. It has to be bigger than twice the mass of the muon plus, you know, whatever mass, you know, that's just the kinetic energy, right? And that means that in this experiment, the electron mass can be neglected, right? So let's drop the electron mass term. And the second term then is K1 slash gamma mu, K2 slash gamma nu minus mass of the muon, but let's drop the mu index because we have only one mass in the problem now. This is what we have. Okay. And then in that same tutorial, problem number 10 told us that the trace of four gamma matrices give us this identity. Four times K mu P mu plus P mu K nu minus eta mu nu P dot K. Right. So we use this here and here. And then there's about a half a page of algebra that you can do by yourself. And then we get to the result that 1/4 of the sum is 8 e to the power 4 by s squared p2 dot k1 p1 dot k2 plus p2 dot k2 p1 dot k1 plus p1 dot p2 mass of the muon squared. There would be more terms if you had not neglected the. So this is the square of our matrix element. And this is the part. So we are going to plug this into the cross-section formula, differential cross-section formula for 2-to-2 scattering. But this is the part in that formula which comes from quantum field theory, from the Lagrangian, from the theory that we are treating. The other stuff that is in the formula comes from kinematical considerations and phase space measure, okay? So this is the bit which is like, takes the input from theory. The rest of it in the cross-section, they are kinematical. Yes?
Can you remind me which of the spins we're averaging over, which we're summing over?
Sure, yeah. Because our beams are unpolarized. So the initial two beams coming in, electron and positron, they are, we are summing over the spins of each of those.
Sorry.
Yes. No, you're averaging. Averaging means you sum and then you divide by half. So because we have two polarization, two spin states for each of these beams, so we divide by one, by four, and summing over, and sum over the initial. Yes.
So R1 and R2 we're measuring.
No, we are summing over the final ones as well because we are not measuring. That's why we are summing over everything.
Also, could you explain how you see that expression was a trace?
Oh, yeah, sure. So, I mean, you saw how that came about, right? So now what I've done is that this is a row matrix. So it has index A, and it's multiplied from the right by a 4x4 matrix with indices A, B. And that matrix multiplied a column matrix of B. So this is a number. Yes, everything is contracted. And this is also a number, right? And then what we did is that we, now that we have written out all the indices, we can move things around. So I brought this in the beginning. And this, yeah, sorry, this bracket is. So what I mean is that now, This is a column matrix, and this is a row matrix, okay? But if we now sum over the spins of this matrix, of these spinners, then the summation can be, after summing over that, that whole thing can be interpreted as a 4x4 matrix. And this is what we have here. Here it's a this is a row matrix, this is a column matrix, so it's an outer product, and therefore this is a 4x4 matrix. But this 4x4 matrix has a nice expression in terms of the momentum if you sum over the spins, and similarly for the V matrix, the V spinners. Okay, so going from here to here. What is crucial is that we are doing sums over S1 and S2. When we do the sums, you know, we can write this guy with the summation as this thing. What is rest? They don't depend on R or on the spins. So they are not affected by the sum. So we can rewrite this thing as a trace. We could not have written it as a trace if we had not summed over. And that's really why the simplification comes in averaging and summing. Because we can write these guys as these nice traces, which is something you wouldn't be able to do if you were writing down amplitudes which were helicity dependent. Okay? Things get a lot more hairy. Okay. So, later in the lecture, I will point out a symmetry of amplitudes called crossing symmetry. But you have to keep in mind that the amplitude is something very mathematical, but the physical thing that we measure is the cross section. So the physics that you get from two different processes depend both on the amplitude as well as the measure and how, when you use the measure to integrate over, what kind of result you get. So let's look at this amplitude squared in the center of mass frame. So in the center of mass frame, we have an electron and an anti-electron coming in, say with momentum p1 and p2, and then they collide and stuff happens here that only nature knows what happens, described by quantum field theory. You can compute it by quantum field theory. Muons and antimuon, muon and antimuon go out, like this, at some angle theta. Okay? Because these process, this is a collinear process, we can always, you know, rotate them into a plane, right? If there are more particles, then we probably couldn't have. So in the massless limit, P1 of mu is, has this form. And then P2 is, because we're in the center of mass frame, has to be minus of P1, the momentum, the three momentum bit. And then similarly, K1 of mu is, it's a same part, same energy, and then I've written it in some general K, and K2 would be E. This is an elastic scattering, in a sense, I guess. Oh, it's not elastic, sorry. And then the K is related to also the center of mass energy is twice of E. Yeah, I just realized there's a typo in my notes. Yeah. No, that's correct, yeah. So, yeah, there's a typo in my notes, okay. And what are the other things? We also need S. S is P1 plus P2. And you can see from there, it's P1 plus P2 squared, and this is nothing but 4E squared. So to evaluate this, we need to compute P1 plus K2 is E squared plus E K cosine of theta, which is the same thing as P2 dot K1. And P1 dot K1 is E squared minus E of K cosine squared, which is the same thing as P2 dot K2. And lastly, we have P1 dot P2, which is 2E squared. So we can plug all of this in, and then what we have is do a bit of manipulation. I'm not going to do all the details here. And we get the following. 1/4 with the summation is e to the power 4 1 plus m squared e squared, then plus 1 minus m squared e squared cosine squared of theta. Now remember the differential cross-section formula for 2-2-2 scattering in the center of mass frame from Dan's lectures. So this is the differential cross-section. It's given by the energies of the incoming particles, the mod of the difference of the velocities of the incoming particles is 16 pi squared the momentum of the final particle, one of the final particles, and then 1/4 of summed over m squared. So all of this is kinematical, and this is coming from our Feynman diagrams. So for our case, E1 and E2 are equal to E center of mass divided by 2. And our initial photon, so electrons are relativistic, so they're moving at the speed of light, but in opposite direction. So this is just 2 in our case. So putting this together, we get, and also the final momentum, which I've written out as k there. Putting this together, we get 32. Too bad it's not 42. Cubed of center of mass. And keep e squared here times this guy. Now, what am I missing here? Okay, no, nothing. So it's conventional to express QED calculations not in terms of E squared, which is the square of the charge of the electron, which measures the strength of interaction, but by a constant called alpha, and this alpha is called the structure constant, right?
Fine structure
constant, exactly. Sorry. So it probably has some, it has the atomic physics origin probably. And that's given by E squared by 4 pi, and I'm just writing out h bar and c because although we are putting h bar equals to 1, c equals to 1. So the experimentally measured value of alpha, which of course gives you the experimentally measured value of E, is at low energies is 137.04. You'll see in Francois's course that this alpha becomes a momentum dependent and energy dependent quantity. And as you increase energy, it actually increases. The analogous quantity in QCD actually decreases with increasing energy, a phenomena called asymptotic freedom. But you have to take into account loop corrections to see that. Anyway, if you introduce alpha, which has a rather small value, and then plug in all of this in here and then do the integral, then you get the total cross section. And the total cross section is 1/3 alpha squared E of center of mass 1 minus mu m squared e squared 1 plus 1/2 m squared by e squared. So I've really skipping some algebraic steps because I really want to do a few more interesting stuff before we are through. But one last comment is that if you take your energy to be very large, the center of energy, center of mass energy. So for large center of mass energy, so much, much larger than the muon mass, this formula asymptotes to 1/3 alpha squared of E of center of mass. So So if I had asked you to guess what the total cross-section is for the creation of muon and antimuon in a very high-energy experiment involving electrons, what would you have guessed? You would have said, okay, I'm going to draw a Feynman diagram where an electron comes in and a positron comes in, annihilates, and then, you know, we have a muon and antimuon. The cross-section better be proportional to so there'll be two E's coming here, the electron, the vertex factor. So when we square this, this would better be proportional, will be proportional to alpha squared, right? You can guess that. So I'm doing dimensional analysis. And because we're at a very high energy, the only energy that's going to matter is going to be the energy of the center of mass frame. And therefore, just by dimensional grounds, the cross-section has, you know, its dimensions is that of area, so which is length square, which is the inverse in natural units, that's the inverse of energy. So that means I'm missing E here, and I think I'm also missing a square here. Okay, so that's a good thing about dimensional analysis. It lets you figure out where you have major typos. If you are a physicist and you're in the business of calculating cross sections of diagram, never ever calculate a cross section before trying to estimate it. Because you see, we got very close to the asymptotic value just by dimensional analysis, right? You needed, of course, you didn't need to know the structure of quantum field theory, but you can get close to the right answer just by trying to guess. So we had to do all these calculations to figure out 4/3 here. This is something that you'll use a lot if you're doing cosmology, for example, and you're talking about early universe and what is the cross-section of a certain particle will be created in an early universe. In the early universe, things are hot. The only energy scale is set by the temperature of the universe. So you can actually guess the cross-sections a lot of times. You have to know, because if, for example, the interaction was a little bit different, it'll probably give you different diagrams. But then from that, you can guess what the cross-section is, okay? In the explorations in particle theory, which is a theory about dark matter mostly, you will do a lot of guesstimation of cross-sections there. Okay, now back to doing a bit more formal stuff is I want to talk a bit about crossing symmetry. Okay, there'll be crossing symmetry question in your homework assignment that'll go out today. So, so compare that diagram with the diagram that you get from the scattering of electrons and muons, okay? So the diagram for scattering of electrons and muon is that an electron comes in, a muon comes in, so this is muon, with some momentum p2, and goes out some momentum p2 prime, exchanges a photon with an electron, so this is an electron, with momentum p1 and momentum p1 prime. then the amplitude for this guy is u bar of p1 prime minus ie of gamma mu u of p1 I eta eta mu nu t. So now this is p2 minus p2 prime. So that's no longer s. U bar of p2 prime minus ie gamma mu of u of p2. I'm kind of ignoring for the spin indices. Now, if you do the same thing, which we are not going to do, and compute this, you get an expression that is remarkably similar to that expression, the final expression that is hidden under there. But let's bring this out. So the first line of the middle word. It's trace of p1 prime slash plus, let's just keep the electron mass for now because we are talking about exact stuff, p1 slash plus m of electron gamma nu, new trace begins, p2 slash prime m of mu gamma of mu p2 slash plus m of mu gamma of nu trace ends bracket ends. So you can get this from the other one, you know, with the caveat that we ignored electron mass in the other one. But if he had carried it through, there would be an exact correspondence between those two guys under the interchange of p2 going to minus p1 prime, k2 going to minus p2. And the other momenta, say, just relabeling p1 to be p1 and relabeling k1 to be p2 prime. So in other words, what we're doing is that we're taking the So we are taking from that diagram p2, which was an incoming positron, and made that into an outgoing electron here, right? So let me put arrows here to make it clear. And k2 over there was the label of an outgoing anti-muon. And now we have flipped that, taken that line, and kind of switched into an ingoing muon. So although I've written the amplitude square to make the, you know, to show that these two expressions are same under these interchanges of initial particle and final particle, the this is. This is an expression of an underlying symmetry of your amplitudes in any quantum field theory, known as crossing symmetry. And the general statement of crossing symmetry is So the general statement of crossing symmetry is that you have some amplitude with some particle which has some momentum p, and it has other particles in the process. And that's equal to another amplitude of a different process. It's never the same process. And you can show that the energy and the momentum relations never satisfy. You cannot satisfy both. With all everything remaining the same, but the final particle, the initial particle becoming a final antiparticle with its momentum reversed. Okay. So we have some, by here I mean we've got some particle with other particles, say, going into some final particle. Here, the initial particles are the same, except this particle is no longer there. It's going to, the final particles are the same with the antiparticle of that with the momentum reversed. Okay. Now, Peskin has a very short proof of crossing symmetry for the quantum field theories that they talk about, scalars and spinners and things like that. But crossing symmetry is something that we believe to be true for all quantum field theories, you know, and it's also an exact symmetry. And in conformal field theories, for example, crossing symmetry is a very powerful tool that is used quite often. Okay. The last thing, maybe the second last thing, depending on how time things go, I want to talk about is photon polarization sum. In the tutorial today, we'll do a problem which involves initial and final photons. We haven't done such a problem yet. So like the electron and the muon cases, we are interested in this course on initial photon states which are averaged over the polarizations, and the final polarizations are summed over. So we are not, that means you're not using a detector which detects the polarization of the photon, or that the initial beam of the photon is unpolarized. For that we need analogous, so here we did the sum over the spins for the fermions, but we need an analogous formula for the photons. And because we are always carrying around unphysical degrees of freedom in the photon, that sum is a little bit tricky. Okay, so let's choose our photon polarizations to be, let's say this is our light-like photon. So let's call this eta to be 1. And the physical degrees of photon, they have the form that the zero component, the light light-like component, so time-like. Time-like component is 0. And it, they have some, the three component have some form, which have so these guys satisfy E1 of K. Let's take them to be plane polarized. So they're orthogonal and real. And they are orthogonal to the direction of the propagation in three space. Now the longitudinal photon, the general expression for the longitudinal photon is actually given by this. You take the direction, the momentum of your photon and subtract from it the time-like direction. So n dot k gives you the projection of k along n. And then you subtract it, and you normalize the whole thing. And for the time being, let's not set k squared equals to 0, although that's true for a physical photon. So any amplitude that involves an external photon will have form of, will be of this form. So it'll be some other amplitude, you know, what am I doing? So, sorry, any amplitude of a photon with some polarization lambda will have this form, where mu is the space-time index, and lambda is the polarization index. And when we average or sum over the photon polarizations, we'll be summing over lambda, but we'll be summing over the physical degrees of freedom because these are external photons, so you have created them carefully to be physical. So this will have some m star of mu, m of nu. Now, these can be circularly polarized. If photons are circularly polarized, they're complex, their polarization. Sorry, this should be epsilon. It should be notationally. So this has going, so let's put a star here, but it could be real. And there's a lambda here. And for this guy, there is a nu, and there's a lambda. Right? This is what we want to, what we mean by photon, you know, polarization sums. Right. But okay, yeah, good. So, but remember that we actually imposed, if we had summed over all of them, all the degrees of polarization, so if we had done mu, lambda, nu, lambda, eta, lambda, lambda, then we would have gotten eta, mu, nu, right? But the problem is here we are summing over everything. So we cannot, and you know, in the case of complex circular polarization, we can put complex conjugates there. So we can now express these guy as, so we can write this as sum over all four components minus the two components that we didn't take, that we didn't sum over. When you sum over all four components, you get eta. So sum over the first one and two of eta lambda of mu star. Sorry, not eta, epsilon lambda of nu gives you minus eta mu nu, and from the two unphysical degrees of freedom, you get this term. You get k mu nu, k, and now I've used the normalization that k squared is zero, the physical condition, k dot n, and the cross term between the longitudinal and the time-like component is this, okay? So you get this guy. So all of this has to be contracted with m's. So note that apart from this guy, every term has a k in it, an uncontracted k, which is the photon momentum, four momentum. So let's ask the question, what happens when you contract the k with m? And my claim is that it's zero.
Why is it minus eta mu?
Sorry?
Why is it a minus sign in front of eta mu?
Why is there a minus sign? There is probably a sign. That's not important for us right now. Oh, yeah. Because here, the time-like components have minus signs in them. So my claim is, k contracted with mu is, is zero. And this is actually a statement of gauge invariance. So to see this, consider that suppose you have some a mu, which is of this form. Now this is a solution to the gauge fixed equation. So in the Lorentz gauge, so you know, okay, so if you now do a gauge transformation like this, what happens is that your polarization vector but this is now space-time index, changes by some factor I k times f. It's because this derivative brings down a factor of k here. So if your amplitude is going to be gauge invariant, then it better be that the K contracted with M is zero. So this is, so if you impose this, then we can make the statement that when you do polarization sums over the physical amplitude, you can, so lambda 1 and 2, epsilon lambda mu of star, epsilon lambda nu, some amplitude star of m, the same amplitude. This is equal to eta mu nu . In other words, in cross-section calculations, where you can always replace this sum, by the metric tensor. This is, as Peskin shows, my argument here is not an equality. But effectively, when you do the polarization sum, you can use that. Okay? So this is the polarization sum rule. This guy, on the other hand, which I have not proved, which is an important statement about the gauge invariance of quantum field theory, it's got subtle issues. And unfortunately, I don't think you see that at any time at PSI, but you should really look it up. It's called Ward identity. And there are related stuff called in the non-abelian gauge, it's sometimes called Ward-Takahashi identity, I think maybe that's a. And in non-abelian gauge theories, there are identities analogous, which are called Slavnov-Taylor identities. So what they do is that they impose, the Ward identities are statements of gauge invariance of your theory at the level of amplitudes, or in a perturbation theory level. Okay. So using Ward identity, which I am justifying by using the fact that our amplitude needs to be gauge invariant, we arrive at the polarization sum. Okay, now for the last thing, I'm going to start on a calculation for Compton scattering. It's quite a long called calculation. I won't get through it before the end of lecture, but we'll continue it in today's tutorial. We're almost there. We're almost there. You know, this morning after my breakfast, I went back to my bedroom, and the cats were all piled up on each other and, napping away. And I didn't want to come. I understand your feeling, but. Sorry? Interesting question. Enough to make a pile, let's just say. But I have imposed a cutoff there. Imposed by the practicalities of traveling as well as a salary. Yes.
So a photon is spin 1. Right?
Yes.
So it has 4 different possible spin states that are reflected in the components of A.
Yes.
But with a gauge invariance, some of them become unphysical.
Right.
If we had a larger gauge invariance, could they all?
No. It's a generic feature of massless vector particle. Massless particle, tensor particle. So you mean bosons, but you know they're massless, that they have only two helicities or two degrees of freedom. You always have some gauge invariance, you know, which will get rid of all the other components. So for example, the graviton, which is described by a 4x4 symmetric, you know, tensor, because you can write it as a theory of massless particles, it also has only 2 degrees of freedom. Yeah. So gravitational waves, for example, has only two polarizations, right? So it's a generic feature, yeah. So probably. This answers your question, but so the gravitational degrees of freedom, the degrees of freedom for the graviton is bigger than the degrees of freedom for the photon. But the gauge degrees of freedom are also such that at the end of the day, the physical degrees of freedom are still two. So I think you're right. I think what you're saying is that if you had bigger gauge degree of freedom, would you have fewer physical degrees of freedom? So rather than say, you know, I would say yes, but it's not possible to implement a bigger gauge degree of freedom for the case of photon, right? Because the photon action doesn't have a bigger gauge degree of freedom. Okay. It has some more global symmetries, but, you know.
The conformal symmetry. Yeah.
But can you repeat what is the m in what I did?
Sorry, what is that?
The m.
M is an amplitude. M is the amplitude we got from right. So we had a lambda here. So if you have some polarized photon in our external space, then we can always write our Feynman rules tells us put an epsilon polarization tensor for that photon, right? That means we can write that as, this is the four component polarization of the photon. And then the word identity tells us that this is it. In fact, you know, I will argue, I don't know if I'll get to that, the unphysical degrees of photon, the polarization that you get in the covariant quantization of the Lorentz gauge always has, the unphysical degree, it always has this thing. And therefore, you know, whenever you, any formula that you get, any physically measurable quantity that you get from QED, which has some photon polarization in it, if you replace the photon polarization by K, it has to vanish. Otherwise, you know, it won't be gauge invariant, which is also a statement of the fact that the longitudinal photon cancels the contribution from the time-like photon. Okay, so Compton scattering. So historically, Compton scattering was important because it showed that light has a particular nature or particle nature. Because Einstein had postulated that light is, you know, absorbed and emitted in quanta, and then, you know, So Compton scattering is a scattering of light off electrons. So the Feynman diagrams associated to this are, you get some electron going about its business, and with some momentum P, spin S, but a photon comes in and gets absorbed. The photon has momentum Q, and then the electron, you know, emits, and let's label this mu and nu, Q prime is the outgoing photon, and the outgoing electron momentum is P prime and S prime. But it could have happened easily that, and it does happen, everything happens in quantum mechanics that is allowed to happen, that the electron emits the photon before it absorbs the incoming photon. So here it's again Q and mu Q prime, P prime, S prime. So so the amplitude for this is, so here we have only one fermion line, so it's in each diagram. So let's start here. So coming here at this point, we have an electron that is emitted. So we have a U bar of S prime P prime. Epsilon, let's call the outgoing epsilon polarization epsilon out. And it has Q. And then we have a vertex factor of like this. And now we have a fermion propagator, which is P slash Q slash plus the mass of the electron divided by P plus Q whole squared minus M squared. So this is this guy. Here it's P plus Q. And then we come here, so we have another photon. Now we write the other vertex factor and with that we contract the polarization of the incoming photon and then at this point we have an incoming electron that is absorbed so we have U of S of P. And the second term now, unlike the other, some of the diagrams that the electron positron scattering that I described yesterday, I wrote down the amplitude for yesterday, there is no relative minus sign here. There's only, and you can, you know, show that yourself. So for the second diagram, you know, the electron bits do not change, but the photon bits get exchanged, in becomes out. So we can, the momentum changes of the internal electron propagator because it already absorbed a photon before emitting. Out of and U S of P. Right. Now we can simplify this expression by observing that the photons satisfy this and that the electrons, which are in the external electrons, satisfy this. And then we get a if you now use these in the denominators, we get
an expression which is minus I e squared u bar s prime p prime some stuff involving gamma matrices, which I'm going to call u, divided by 2 p dot q, some other stuff minus p dot q prime. And I won't have time to show it now, but we'll do it in the tutorial. Is you might ask now, what if I make a gauge transformation? Does this expression remain invariant? So as I said, if you make a gauge transformation, that's equivalent to shifting the polarization by a k mu, where k is, well, the polarization vector by a vector that is proportional to the photon. So for example, if I now replace E, which had momentum, four momentum Q, by Q, and then we look at this expression carefully and use some of the properties of, use the equations, the momentum space Dirac equations, which are these guys, and u bar of the same thing, then you can show that although these two terms individually don't vanish under this replacement, they cancel out. So the contribution from the unphysical degrees of freedom of the photon cancel out order by order in perturbation theory when you take into account all the diagrams involved. Okay, that's a statement of gauge invariance as well. And we'll get into the detail today, but I think I shall stop here. Thank you for listening. Shucks, we don't get t-shirts, Dan. Well, we do, but not in the class. Okay, any more questions? Or yes?
You promised us the meaning of life, it's not a class.
yeah, it came out 32, not 42, yeah. Like, yeah.
It was last time you missed it.
So, which one? Anything else, or? Okay, let's see you in this tutorial at 3:30 today. Cool, thank you.
I don't think it's 32.